And now a podcast conversation with Sally Pipes, who is the executive director, the CEO of a very important general conservative think tank, namely the Pacific Research Institute. But you, Sally, have been particularly drawn to, occupied with, should one say, obsessed by the question of national health care.
Yes, I have been obsessed with national health care. I grew up in Canada under the Medicare for All system, where private health insurance was outlawed. And so I came to this country in 1991 to take over Pacific Research Institute. And I was hardly at my desk when an initiative appeared on the California ballot, a single payer initiative. And then, of course, we had Hillary Care in 1993-94. So I am very involved in this healthcare reform debate. And my really passion is that I do not want the federal government to take over the American healthcare system.
But tell me, were you, as a healthcare economist, ever drawn in as a consultant or attending a large meeting around a big table in Washington, whether for the original Hillary Care failed operation or for Obamacare?
Yes. Well, I mean, I was very involved in anti-Hillary Care, and of course, starting in 2008, when the president was the senator, when he was talking about what he wanted to do about healthcare reform. And so then, he was elected in the fall of 2008, and that became, healthcare reform became his number one policy agenda issue. And so I've been, battling this forever. I've been to Washington. I've met with senators. I've met with members of the House. I've met with staffers. I mean, it's just such a passion for me to finally, by 2016, get this healthcare reform, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, repealed and replaced with a healthcare reform that actually brings about affordable, accessible, quality care for all.
You have, of course, been the author of two earlier books, The Truth About Obamacare, and then The Pipes Plan, The Top 10 Ways to Dismantle and Replace Obamacare. And now a new pamphlet, one might call it, or Encounter Books, who publish it, call them broadsides, a broadside titled The Cure for Obamacare. And we will come to that shortly. But I must start on a personal note. I was rather troubled by something I picked up just last night on the Internet, namely a release about something that is contemplated for almost immediate action by whoever is administering the early form of Obamacare, namely that certain kinds of professional organizations for, quote, artists are to be deprived of the opportunity to provide individual health care via their present health care systems and must go to Obamacare. One of those organizations is one that I belong to, namely the one for television and radio artists, AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, for which I've been a member, and indeed they are the tertiary provider for the health care that my wife and I enjoy. My primary, being an older guy, is Medicare. My secondary is Blue Cross, provided by the University of Chicago, where I labored for many years. But my AFTRA is going to be taken away. Should I be distressed?
Well, I definitely think so. I mean, we are seeing so much coming out in the mainstream media and from Department of Health and Human Services and from the president himself on Obamacare. I think one of the big issues is that starting in July, the president and the HHS, they announced that they were going to delay the employer mandate for 1 year to January 1st, 2015. They announced that, people who are eligible for these subsidies under the Affordable Care Act are not going to have verification of their income. We saw the House vote in favor of delaying the employer mandate for a year and also the individual mandate. We're seeing so many things. We've seen the unions now, the AFL-CIO, what you're talking about is your union too. The unions are now becoming very concerned about Obamacare because they see the 40-hour work week, which they live by, is going to be destroyed because under Obamacare, under the employer mandate, any employer is considered any employee is considered full-time if they work 30 hours a week or more. So the unions are upset about that, and the unions are upset about the cost of healthcare. But we're seeing not only unions such as yours dropping healthcare, we're seeing a lot of major companies. For example, UPS, the big United Parcel Service, they announced a couple of weeks ago that they would no longer be providing health insurance for the spouses, 15,000 spouses of employees at UPS. Delta Airlines announced that their healthcare costs are going to go up by $100 million. The University of Virginia has said, you know, they're going to be cutting back on hours to below 30 to, you know, reduce their exposure. So, you know, this law, there's a lot of things, unintended consequences are coming out.
You know, it just occurs to me. I see a likely stance that will be taken by progressives, using the term that they now use to describe the left, who are in favor of Obamacare, but who now may be somewhat worried about the reduction to a work week of 29.5 hours. It's going to occur to one of their policy people pretty soon. Well, that's okay. We just have to raise salaries so that for 29.5 hours, you get the equivalent of what you used to get for 40 hours, which is essentially a reduction in the amount of labor required to maintain a living wage.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, we're seeing, you know, those people, employees of the, you know, people that work in the service sector, like Denny's, you know, Red Lobster, all of these, you know, service sector.
Yes, they were already clamoring for a considerable increase in wages, to be sure.
Right, absolutely. And you're going to see that, you know, young people that I've talked to, a number of young people that have, you know, work in the fast food business, and they're absolutely astounded that their hours are going to be cut and that they are going to have to go out and buy their own insurance in these state-based exchanges.
And as their salaries are raised, so will the prices of the commodities they help to peddle. And so thus will the essential working costs or life costs of everybody in this country. So it's another indirect route to inflation.
Well, yes, exactly. Because, you know, for those of us who, like myself, who love hamburgers, you know, I will be faced with seeing a price increase because, you know, employers, whether they provide health coverage or whether they provide, you know, goods and services, all of their costs are passed on to us as consumers.
So we can look forward to the dawn in a year or two, perhaps, of the $10 Big Mac. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. That's, of course, I'm hoping that by early in 2017, this legislation will be repealed and replaced so that we can actually develop a healthcare plan that empowers patients and doctors and not the federal government.
Let me tell you now about, I'm still being a touch personal, but it relates to what we're talking about. Let me tell you about my physician. I only took him on as a physician fairly recently, but he's well known around Chicago. And he says he's disappointed with Obamacare because it does not go far enough. He is in favor of single payer instantly, so much so that though he was Obama's personal physician here in Chicago for 20 years before Obama went to the U.S. Senate and then rather quickly and surprisingly to the presidency, that physician, I won't give his name at the moment, who had been Obama's personal physician for 20 years, went to Washington to lobby against the newly announced Obamacare because it did not go far enough. And he tells me there are lots of organizations of doctors who feel that the only way to go is with single payer care in the pattern set in Canada, where, as everyone knows, health care works wonderfully well and everybody's happy.
Well, you know, I mean, this doctor you're talking about, I don't know who it is, but he's probably one of the docs who is behind this organization called Physicians for National Health Insurance.
He is.
And there are a lot of docs. This is an organization that promotes single payer, i.e. Medicare for all. And, you know, being Canadian and growing up in Canada, the federal government took over the healthcare system in the 1970s, and the system is operated by each of the provinces. But private health insurance is outlawed in Canada under the Canada Health Act. But, you know, Canada spends 11.4% of their gross domestic product on healthcare. Here in America, we spend close to 18%. People say that is just way too much. We spend more than any other country in the world. I don't know if it's too much. You know, America is a very wealthy country. We demand the very best. But in Canada, where the government says we can only spend 11.4% of GDP, the demand for healthcare is a lot greater than the supply. And so what happens? You have long waiting lists for care, you have care being rationed, and you have lack of access to the latest treatments and procedures. The average wait in Canada today from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist is 17.8 weeks. That's over 4 months. Does an American want to have to wait 4 months to get an MRI if they think, you know, they might have a brain tumor or something more serious?
What do public opinion polls on attitude towards the Canadian health system, what do they show up in Canada?
Well, you know, one of the big polling firms up there is Decima, and they do regular surveys. And if you survey the population at large, you know, they tend to support the Canadian healthcare system. The reason being is if you don't need to use the healthcare system for, you know, anything major, you don't need a specialist, for example, you know, it's all fine if you can go to your general practitioner for the cold, the sore throat. But when they poll those people who need specialized care, then it goes way, way down. You know, Canadians, not just wealthy Canadians, average Canadians come to the United States about 40,000 a year out of a population of 35 million. They come to the United States and pay out of pocket for procedures that they'd be on a waiting list for in Canada for a long time. So they have that escape valve, Canadians. They can come here. But when the people that need care are polled, it polls very badly because people have to wait. And old people don't have access to the kind of care that they would have access to here.
When you pay out of pocket, if you're a Canadian, you don't have the you pay a heavier price than would the ordinary American who's got some insurance at the moment, so that the Medicare costs and then Blue Cross or whatever, all of them are sufficiently reduced to the real price, which very often turns out to be 1/4 or 1/5 of the original stated price. But they pay the original stated price, do they? The visiting Canadians.
Well, Canadians don't pay anything for their health care. But what happens is you can't call up a specialist. You can't call up your ophthalmologist or your OBGYN and say, I'd like to come in and see you tomorrow, next week, next month, whatever. In Canada, you have to go to a gatekeeper. You have to go to your general practitioner.
But when a Canadian comes down to see an American ophthalmologist, does Canadian health care pay for him?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
and as I say,
point.
Private health care is outlawed. You'll see in Canada, in newspapers like the Globe and Mail, the National Paper, the Financial Times, you will see clinics along the border, whether it's Detroit, Seattle, advertising saying, come to the United States if you want an MRI tomorrow.
Very interesting. Of course, we have the great quotation, it will probably live in the annals of American political quotations for a while, from Nancy Pelosi, who says, if you want to understand this bill, well, we passed the bill and now we have to read it to understand it, something like that. In other words, the bill was passed without anybody or most people really understanding what was in it. And indeed, it was under strong pressure from the Democratic National Committee and all those who run the Democratic Party. And they got a almost totally unanimous vote from Democrats. And I don't think there was a single congressional Republican who voted for it. Have we by now read it closely enough to find out what's really in it?
Yes. Yeah, so Nancy Pelosi made that famous statement 11 days before President Obama signed the 2,700-page Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act into law on March 23rd, 2010. She made that statement, we have to pass this bill so we can find out what's in it. I think October 1st is the deadline for the opening of these exchanges where individuals and small businesses will supposedly be able to get their insurance. I think my feeling is that a lot of these exchanges will not be ready to be opened. When the American public, when individuals find out how expensive it is to purchase insurance in the exchange, what the network of doctors and hospitals they will have access to, what the what the deductible will be, I think the American people are finally going to wake up and be in arms against this legislation, which, as you say, was passed without a single Republican vote.
But the mandates requiring that everybody be a member one way or another, those mandates have now been altered so that there are exemptions, particularly exemptions for congresspersons and I suppose their staffs, and also exemptions handed out now to major unions that clamored for the passage of Obamacare.
Yes, well, on the issue of members of Congress. About 3 months ago, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid sort of floated a trial balloon that maybe members of Congress, their staff, and committee members should be exempt from the Affordable Care Act. Well, you can imagine there was a huge outcry about that. So they pulled back on that. So members of Congress and their staffers have to purchase insurance in the exchange. So if you're in D.C., you would purchase your insurance in the D.C. exchange. Committee members do not have to participate in the exchange. But if you look back to a few weeks ago, remember there was a big thing when employees, congressional staffers, realized that they're going to lose, you know, that 75% that the federal government pays, i.e. we pay, for these people to get subsidized health care under the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan. So now they've made a ruling that these congressional staffers are going to get tax subsidies paid for by us in order to help them purchase insurance in the exchange. So that was a real shock, and that's an additional cost on us as taxpayers.
What is the logic of the plan as originally proposed? And for that matter, does it draw significant inspiration from other already established national health plans, whether the Canadian or the British Health Service or most of the Western European countries have national health plans of one sort or another?
Well, you know, the president, you know, when he gave 58 speeches on healthcare reform before March 23rd, 2010. Originally, he started talking about healthcare reform, but by August of 2009, he was no longer talking about healthcare reform. He was talking about health insurance reform. And remember, Nancy Pelosi also said, you know, the insurers in this are the villains. I think, you know, the president wanted a healthcare bill that cost $900 billion over 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office costed it out at $940 billion over 10. They've already revised that number up to $1.8 trillion over the decade 2013 to 2022. I think it's going to cost about $2.7 trillion from 2014 to 2023. But he wanted universal coverage, and he wanted to bend the cost curve down. We already know that neither of those goals are going to be achieved. Still, 30 million Americans will be uninsured by 2016. And this cost curve is not bending down. As I say, it's bending up, and the Congressional Budget Office has already showed that. I think really what the president wants in the long run, he said this before he became a senator, I think what Nancy Pelosi wants, what Jim McDermott from Washington State wants, and what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wants, they really want a single-payer Medicare for all system. That is their long-term goal. And I think if we get into this in greater detail on the exchanges, what's going to happen to the price of how insurers are going to be able to survive under this plan, I think ultimately insurers will be crowded out. The president will say, well, we tried the competitive marketplace and the insurers didn't comply, and therefore we have to go to what the late Senator Ted Kennedy called Medicare for all.
Well, let me come to one particular problem that begins to seem important to me, will be more important as I go on aging, namely what happens to people who reach the age range where there's a fair amount of trouble, a fair amount of disease, and where, in fact, death begins to rear its interesting head. Years ago, on a regular radio program that I did, there came a fellow, it happened twice, from an outfit called the Hastings Institute. And they were very concerned with healthcare problems, and particularly, and apparently, with people getting very old and then requiring vast medical repair and vast medical coverage from private, or for that matter, from public insurance institutions. They virtually were saying there will come a time when the old have to get out of the way and die quietly. And that has to be reflected, or that has to be incentivized through what we do with medical insurance. You know about that early work at the Hastings Institute?
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular work, but I've done a lot of work on the issue of ration care and, you know, the whole issue of, you know, when is it time, you know, to say we can't spend any more money. But the real issue is, in all of these issues, is who makes the decision about when it's time to pull.
And we are increasingly concerned, ordinary folks who hear about Obamacare and read about it, if only in the papers rather than in the technical realm, concerned with the establishment of what we call, and the Obama administration denies that we have any right to this vocabulary, but it has been called by journalists, death panels.
Yes, and Sarah Palin, when she was you know, running along with John McCain as the VP candidate, talked about death panels. I don't like to talk about death panels, but I do like to talk about care being rationed. And the question is, who determines this? Is it a doctor and the patient and the family? Or is this up to the federal government to make decisions about when too much money is being spent and it's no longer time to keep this person alive? And my belief is that it should be between doctors and patients and families, not the federal government. But this is a huge issue. But under Obamacare, we're going to see a lot of rationing because, as I said earlier, costs are going to be out of control and they're going to have to start denying care. If you look at the law, under the law, IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, this is a board which, if the president ever appoints the 15 members, which he was supposed to have appointed by April of this year and hasn't. And I think the reason is because he knows that a lot of Democrats see this body as a rationing board where doctors will have their income and hospitals will see their income reduced because they have to reduce the cost of care for those people on Medicare. So, you know, this is another form of, you know, global budgets, IPAP. These are ways to ration care, and it will result in the elderly getting less care than they do today. And it's interesting, Milt, that 1 in 3 new Medicare eligible patients today is already having a hard time finding a doctor. And, you know, there are a number of surveys out. Deloitte's 2013 healthcare survey shows that 6 in 10 doctors are expecting to retire early in the next 1 to 3 years, and it's because of Obamacare.
Will it also tend to lead to a reduction in self-recruitment into medical school?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, America has been a place where the best and the brightest have applied to medical schools and have become doctors. But when they see, you know, young students are seeing that, you know, their incomes will be controlled, how they practice medicine will be controlled. All of these things, I think, will be disincentives for the best and the brightest to go into the healthcare. And 49% even today of graduating residents in specialties are now joining hospitals. They are not joining, going into private practice or joining small groups. So, you know, we're seeing this centralization of control already because of Obamacare.
Is this what happened a long time ago in England with their national health system?
Right. Well, the British, you know, it's interesting. Sir Winston Churchill was the first person to talk about a national health program. Who would have thought it? But of course, he wasn't the person that actually brought it into being, but he was the first person to start talking about it. And so the National Health Service in Britain was born in 1947, so a long time before the Canadian system. What they did was they allowed private health care, though, to run alongside the national health care system. And today, about 10% of Brits have private health insurance, and they use it when they know they have something serious. They'll use the NHS for, you know, a cold or a sore throat. But when they need care, and they don't want to be on a waiting list or on a gurney or not having access to an ambulance, they use their private health insurance. So
I asked you a moment ago about Canadian public opinion. What is the state of affairs now in American public opinion in response to Obamacare as we see it coming on?
Well, so the law is, you know, 3.5 years old. Early on, you know, 55% of Americans wanted to see the law repealed. That number has remained constant. And I think when these exchanges that are supposed to open on October 1st, when there are delays, when people find out, I think that number is going to go vastly up. Wall Street Journal, NBC News did a poll a couple of weeks ago, and they showed that 47% of those Americans polled think the law is a bad one, and only 34% think Obamacare is a good law. So we're seeing, you know, that the American people do not support this. And, you know, we certainly saw in the 2010 midterm elections with the Tea Party movement, there was a lot of animosity towards Obamacare. Unfortunately, I think in the 2012 election, when the candidate on the Republican side was Mitt Romney, you know, he brought in Romney Care in Massachusetts in 06. And so, you know, and the person, Professor John Gruber at MIT helped design both Romney Care and Obamacare. Romney Care is a microcosm of Obamacare. And so Romney never wanted to get into the healthcare debate with Obama. So the issue wasn't really on the agenda. I think if we'd had a different candidate or if he had said, you know, I thought this was a good idea, but but I see the problems and it wasn't, and I wouldn't want the other states and the rest of the country to be faced with this. We would have brought it more to the attention and maybe the election result would have been different.
You remember that it was either Hippocrates or Galen, I suppose, who said that the ultimate desirable state for human beings is mens sana in corpore sano, a sound mind in a sound body. But it seems to me that Obamacare is so scary and so complex and so indecipherable that it tends to disrupt the mind. It does disrupt mind. And if the desideratum is mens sana, a clear mind, if you're going to maintain mens sano, a sound body, I'm not sure that I've got a clear mind anymore on these matters. I'm confounded, confused, and really rendered increasingly apprehensive, as I think must be true of most people who otherwise pride themselves on sort of understanding important issues of public policy.
Well, I mean, what I like to say about understanding healthcare, it's similar to unraveling an onion, many layers and many tearful moments. It's very complicated. And you see that, you know, with members of Congress, a lot of them do not want to, even on the Republican side, they don't want to talk about this issue. It's too complicated for them. And so my role in life and in my books is to educate Americans and try and explain it, healthcare reform, in a way so that they do understand what Obamacare means for their health and their health care.
Now, I want to come directly, I should have sooner, to your new Encounter broadside. A brief volume, sold for just a pittance, obviously, but very interesting and very important, titled The Cure for Obamacare. One might almost say that what we have here is an outline of Pipe's Care. You are not so vain as to put your name on it, but you suggest some 7 or 8 basic changes which can and must be made in coming years. What are they?
Right. Well, you know, I think it was interesting. Remember, a few weeks ago, former Speaker Newt Gingrich was in Boston at a meeting of GOPAC, and he came out and said, you know, that the GOP has no replacement agenda. And of course, that is completely wrong. There are several GOP replacement agendas. Representative Dr. Tom Price has an agenda. Coburn, Ryan, you know, there are a lot of replacement plans out there. Unfortunately, the Republican Party hasn't been able to sort of get its mind around one plan and push it. But so being, you know, so concerned about government takeover of our healthcare, I thought I was asked by Encounter to do a broadside, The Cure for Obamacare, that would be written in a way that the man on the street, the person in the street, I call it the Pitts family, could understand. And so, you know, in this a small pamphlet, I have actually 10 reforms that should be part of a replacement agenda. And they start with, I think, the first one, the most important one, and a number of Democrats supported as well, is to change the federal tax code to level the playing field so that individuals can purchase their health insurance with pre-tax dollars the same way that the 60% of Americans today who have their health insurance through their employer do. You know, the federal government got us into this mess in the first place during World War II when wage and price controls were in. They gave employers the right to write off the cost of providing health care, and we as employees get our health care with pre-tax dollars. If you lose your job or quit your job, go into the individual market, you have to purchase your health care with after-tax dollars. This is really something that needs to be changed so that if we do make that change, I think we will see a gradual buildup of competition in the health care field, because today we don't have a competitive market in health care. 50% of health care today is in the hands of government, whether it's through Medicare for our elderly, Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans, the CHIP program for children, and the Veterans Administration. So that is my first and most important idea and part to be part of a replacement agenda.
Very important. Let's go forward with some of the others.
I'd like to introduce a refundable tax credit for those who do not get their coverage at work, particularly to cover, you know, those people who, you know, are at a lower end of the totem pole. That's very important. I think we need to increase the availability of health savings accounts. You know, HSAs came into being. They are like an IRA, but it's a health savings account where you can put away money each month into a health savings account, and it carries forward tax-free, and so you accumulate that money through your lifetime. It has to be combined with a high-deductible insurance plan, so that you have coverage for catastrophes. Unfortunately, I think the president, Nancy Pelosi, people like Hillary Clinton, they do not like health savings accounts because they do not want to put individuals and doctors in charge of their health care. And, you know, under HSAs, we have about 15 million Americans today have an HSA. They're very popular. And you're seeing a number of businesses, employers and large and small, moving their employees over to HSA plans because there is a reduction in cost. It is cheaper. And when people take control of their health care, they spend their health care dollars much more wisely. Unfortunately, under Obamacare, I think with the whole idea, you know, with the essential benefit plan that is part of Obamacare, all of the things, the mandates and things, it's going to be very difficult for HSAs to expand or even survive unless we repeal and replace this legislation.
Someplace in there, you've also borrowed the great simple idea put forward by Milton Friedman so many years ago concerning education, namely the voucher plan. And you see a voucherization possibility with regard to healthcare, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, even in the state of Arkansas, where there's a Democratic governor, you know, under this Medicaid expansion, where 12 million more Americans will be eligible for Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans, we know even in the state of Massachusetts under RomneyCare that those people that got onto Medicaid under RomneyCare are already facing waiting lists and having a hard time finding a doctor. So the governor of Arkansas is trying to voucherize the healthcare for those people eligible for Medicaid. So, I mean, this is something that is a huge, huge issue. And I think, you know, the 12 million people that get added to Medicaid, when they find out, you know, what this means for them and their access to care and to doctors, they're going to be absolutely furious.
Well, let's quickly review some of the other major considerations in your revision or your cure for Obamacare.
Well, another one is allow people to purchase insurance across state lines. If you live in a state like New York, Massachusetts, or New Jersey, you know, they have these two things, community rating and guaranteed issue, which means an insurer cannot discriminate on your coverage based on your age or your health, the condition of your health, nor can they deny you care when you come to purchase insurance. So these things add tremendously to the cost of a premium, and that's why in a state like New York, they today have the most expensive individual coverage in the country. Young people do not want to buy a healthcare plan that covers in vitro fertilization, alcohol rehabilitation, all of these mandates. Most states have about 48 to 50 mandates. They add 20 to 50% to the cost of healthcare. Then you add on top of that the essential benefit plan under Obamacare, and it's adding tremendously. A young person that lives in New York who wants to have coverage for a catastrophe, you know, he may find the insurance plan he wants in Arizona or Idaho. So people should be able to purchase insurance across state lines and get the kind of plan that fits their individual or their family needs.
A crucial question concerning the future of Obamacare is what ordinary Democrats will be doing. You predict that there will be an increasing dissatisfaction among ordinary folks once they really see Obamacare gearing up and in practice, and they will be talking to their congressmen, including their Democratic congressmen. Do you see any and the Republicans are basically opposed to Obamacare and will remain so. Do you see any possibility that the Democratic ranks will weaken and ultimately split on this so that a repeal of the basic provisions of Obamacare, if not possible now, will be possible in 4 or 5 years?
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, we have seen the House has voted 40 times to repeal the whole
law.
So but of course, that's not. But, you know, the president is never going to, you know, sign a bill to repeal Obamacare because it is his signature issue as part of his.
Yes, it would remain more a matter of the Senate, assuming the House remains properly proportioned as it is now with a Republican majority.
Right. But what we have seen, Milt, over the last couple of years is repeal of certain parts of the law, i.e. on January 1st of this year, the 2.3% medical device tax, it's an excise tax, came into being. And, you know, a number of Democrats support repeal of that. Elizabeth Warren, the, you know, very liberal senator from Massachusetts, supports it. Chuck Schumer in New York, because they know that this tax is going to really reduce job creation and research and development into medical devices, which allow us to live longer and healthier lives. And so we've seen bills to repeal that. We've seen bills to repeal the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, that we talked about earlier. So we, you know, there's also these taxes on insurance companies, on drug companies. All of these things, you know, are adding to the cost of care. And I think you're going to see a number of Democrats split from Obama and the law, particularly when people try to enroll in the exchanges and they find out how costly it'll be, what the coverage will be, what networks they have access to, what the deductibles will be. A number of Democrats are going to say, hey, I thought the president said over and over again, if you like your health insurance and you like your doctor, nothing will change. And then he also said the average family would see its premium go down by $2,500. And the Congressional Budget Office has come out many times and said the average premium for the average family is going to go up by $3,000. So I think the man on the street is going to be realizing they were sold a bill of goods under the Affordable Care Act.
You mentioned earlier that there are some groups of physicians organized in favor of Obamacare. What do we have on the other side within the healthcare provision community, meaning physicians and yet others, surely nurse or organizations and so on? Do we have significant opposition from those who are supposed to provide the care?
Well, we do. We have a growing group. It's been difficult. I'll just say one thing that, you know, the man on the street thinks that the American Medical Association represents all doctors in this country. And in fact, the AMA only represents 17% of doctors in this country. So when the AMA comes out with a pronouncement that they support the Affordable Care Act, they're only speaking on behalf of 17% of doctors. But there are two groups that I'm very fond of. One is called Docs for Patient Care, run by Dr. Hal Schurz. And they've put together a number of doctors who are against Obamacare. And then there's the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, which is also a terrific group. And they both are against Obamacare, and they're in favor of empowering doctors and patients, not the federal government. So these are not huge groups. But when you look at the whole thing of the AMA, it doesn't represent a lot of doctors. And we talked a moment ago about Physicians for National Health Insurance. And I think, you know, this is the real single payer group. And I don't know if you saw the interview, the PBS interview a few weeks ago with Stephen Sebelius with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, when he was asked, you know, if he thought, if his goal was, i.e., single payer, did he want to see the insurance industry be in charge of accessing healthcare? And he said, yes, yes, absolutely yes. He really supports this single payer issue. And I think the goal of people like him, they want to crowd out insurers, and insurers are going to have a tough time in these exchanges. If the older and sicker people, you know, purchase insurance and use the system, and you don't get the young invincibles, I mean, you and I aren't between 18 and 31, but if they don't get the young invincibles to sign up for these exchanges to cover the costs of the claims by the older and sicker people, they are going to be, it's going to be very difficult. And I think you're going to see a lot of private insurers crowded out of the market. And that will be the path to a single payer system. And you've seen how, you know, worried Kathleen Sebelius is. They've been promoting the NBA, the NFL, the National Football League, movie stars, just the Baltimore Ravens are now promoting Obamacare. And then the president had to go out and, you know, find former President Bill Clinton to support the law to be, you know, something. So they know they've got a problem, because young people are going to pay that $95 individual mandate penalty, or 1% of income, rather than spending $200 to $300 a month on healthcare. Young people want healthcare to cover catastrophes, not all of these essential benefits that are part of Obamacare.
You've reviewed these matters with excellent lucidity and, of course, a tremendous clarity in our brief conversation. Let me add or assert that that is true of the new pamphlet or broadside by Sally Pipes, published by Encounter Books, titled The Cure for Obamacare. That is a resource that should be in the hands of anybody who has any concern about these matters. You know, I've not given you a chance, and time is running very short, but I do want to ask you, if only briefly, to say a word about the Pacific Research Institute, of which you are the CEO and have been for some years. What else goes on there?
Right. Well, Pacific Research Institute was founded in 1979. I've been here since 1991. A business school probably would promote to young people to stay in a job for almost 22 years, but it's such fun doing what we're doing. But PRI is a free market think tank. We believe in personal responsibility, individual liberty, and we don't only work in the area of healthcare, sort of my area, but we do a lot of work in education reform. Art Laffer set up his center, the Laffer Center at Pacific Research Institute, where he's doing some really interesting work on setting up a competitive, a dynamic scoring model of the U.S. economy to compete with the Congressional Budget Office's static model. He's got a book coming out on the best of speeches and papers on supply-side economics from the Reagan Revolution. So we've got the Laffer Center. We do a lot of work in the environmental area, promoting getting the government out of environmental issues and trying to dispel the myths around climate change, around fracking, all of these things. So we have a investigative journalism project called Cal Watchdog. So, you know, we call ourselves policy entrepreneurs, putting ideas into action. That is our role. And we've, you know, had a number of great statements by people. Milton Friedman, the late Milton Friedman, was my mentor, and he wrote the foreword to my very first book called Miracle Cure, How to Solve America's Healthcare Crisis and Why Canada Wasn't the Answer. Isn't the answer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And again, I urge all who are listening to get their hands on this fine, important, brief volume, The Cure for Obamacare. Thank you again, Sally.
Thank you so much, Milton. Take care.